On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Norman Mailer has never been shy with his subjects or their treatment. Over nearly six decades, he's taken on World War II, Marilyn Monroe, Lee Harvey Oswald, Muhammad Ali, Jesus, and much more. Now, turning 84, Mailer is taking on the origins of Adolf Hitler and evil itself. This hour, On Point, a conversation with Norman Mailer about his new novel, The Castle in the Forest. Mailer's first novel, The Naked and the Dead, written after his World War II service in the Pacific, made him a literary star at age 25 in 1948. His 40 books since then, novels and journalism, have won him the status of one of the country's great literary figures of the last century. He won a Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction and a National Book Award for his 1968 Armies of the Night, capturing the era of Vietnam War protest. He won another Pulitzer for his 1979 novel, The Executioner's Song. He is co-founder of The Village Voice. His new novel is The Castle in the Forest. Norman Mailer joins me from New York. Norman Mailer, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for that fulsome introduction.
Why not? At 84, I'd say it's well-deserved. Has Adolf Hitler always been on your target list? Did you know, after a list of subjects like that, that you would finally come to him?
I came to him really because I had the good fortune to read a book by Ron Rosenbaum called Explaining Hitler. I think that was the title of his book, but in any event, what he had is he interviewed about 15 well-known authorities on the subject of Hitler, and they each gave their interpretation of what had been Hitler's inner life. And after I finished reading it, I was immensely stimulated by the book, but I also felt that none of the explanations satisfied me. And it occurred to me that I've been thinking about Hitler ever since I was 9 years old, because when I was nine in 1932, my mother, who was a most intelligent woman, but she barely finished high school and was hardworking all her life, she knew already in 1932 that Hitler was an absolute disaster for the Jews. And since we were Jewish, it was most personal.
She told you, as I recall, Norman Mailer, he will kill the Jews.
Yes. Yeah, she knew it. She knew better than the statesmen of that period knew. They all felt, well, once Hitler gets some responsibility, he'll settle down. He'll be more like us. And they were dead wrong. So that gave me two things. One is her fear of Hitler, her detestation of Hitler, was in me early and stayed with me all through the war, Second World War, and has always been a theme in my mind. Always, what made the Nazis tick? What was there about Hitler that was so special? That's always been with me. And now, mind you, there are other elements. It isn't that I spent my whole life doing nothing but think about Adolf Hitler. Far from it. But when you're a novelist, you have subjects that stay in your mind and are there and come back to you from time to time. And this was certainly one of them.
You write about the very young Hitler, in fact, from the moment of conception and before, a product of incest in your telling, multi-generational incest in your novelist's telling, where he ends up being the son of his father and his father's daughter. Lee Siegel in the New York Times calls this story one of naked, wild empathy on your part. I wish you'd give us a sense of the range of characters which, as a novelist, you had to empathize in The Castle in the Forest.
I don't know how to answer that. There's there was the father, Alois. There was the mother, Clara Posel Hitler. There was a beekeeper named Geralta Zauberer, he was called. There's Hitler's older brother, Alois Jr. There's his older sister, Angela, from his father's former marriages. There's his kid brother, Edmund, and who dies early. There's his sister, Paula. It's a crew of people, no question.
You describe Hitler as the product of incest, and this has a lot of import in your telling. You've taken a novelist's
license. I suppose there's a lot that's not factually known here, but give us a sense of where you place him in his own family tree and why the incestuous piece resonates so importantly to you as the novelist here.
The novel begins with Heinrich Himmler giving a speech to a special intelligence group. This is, of course, all made up. It's novelistic.
Sure.
In which he talks about incest creates people who are either awful or extraordinary. He says most of the time it's awful because their genes are so close that they don't have enough variety to survive, and they usually go mad, or they end up very badly, as many incestuous people do, or they end up mentally defective. He says, however, occasionally, the fact that these two sets of genes come together and are highly compatible because the people are related by blood produces a special person. He then goes on to suggest, Himmler does, that that is what made Adolf Hitler so special. And at that point, the person who tells the story, who presents himself first as a member of Himmler's intelligence group, and only later do we find out that he's much more than that. He's an assistant to the devil. But at any rate, he is sent on various expeditions to places where the family had lived, where the ancestors had lived, in order to find out how true the incest might be, and comes back with the conclusion that, yes, that Hitler was an incestuous product, an incestuary, as he calls him.
And with that baby spotted, the devil, the maestro, is interested. His intermediary, the demon, the devil, Dieter, as you name him, the narrator of this novel, is tasked. And off we go with the devil watching over this this new person from the very moment of conception. I wish you'd read a bit for us, if you'd be good enough, Norman Mailer, from page, 71 in The Castle in the Forest, where he's introducing himself as an instrument of the devil.
Yes, I am an instrument. I am an officer of the evil one. And this trusted instrument has just committed an act of treachery. It is not acceptable to reveal who we are. The author of an unsigned and unpublished manuscript can attempt to remain anonymous, but the margin of safety is not large. If from the beginning I have spoken of my fear at undertaking this work, it is because I knew that sooner or later I would have to reveal myself. Now, however, that I have offered this disclosure, there's a shift in the given. I can no longer be envisioned as a Nazi officer. If in 1938 I could pretend to be a trusted aide to Heinrich Himmler by the means, yes, of inhabiting a real SS officer's body, that was temporary. When so ordered, we are always ready to inhabit such roles, such human abodes. I recognize, however, that these remarks can hardly be accessible to the majority of my readers. Given the present authority of the scientific world, most well-educated people are ready to bridle at the notion of such an entity as the devil. They have even less readiness to accept the cosmic drama of an ongoing conflict between Satan and the Lord. The modern tendency is to believe that such speculation is a medieval nonsense, happily extirpated centuries ago by the Enlightenment. The entrance of God may still be acceptable to a minority of intellectuals, but not the belief that there is an opposed entity equal to God or nearly so. One mystery might be allowed, but two, never. That is fodder for the ignorant. There need be no surprise, then, that the world has an impoverished understanding of Adolf Hitler's personality. Detestation, yes, but understanding of him, no. He is, after all, the most mysterious human being of the century. Nonetheless, I would say that I can comprehend his psyche. He was my client. I followed his life from infancy a long way into his development as the wild beast of the century, this all-too-modest-looking politician with his snippet of a mustache.
Norman Mailer, reading from his new novel, The Castle in the Forest. Norman Mailer, we just got a minute before the break. It seems wrong to ask. We'll come back if we need. Do you believe in the devil, a devil?
Well, I certainly believe in God. I don't believe in the God of the fundamentalists, the God who's all judgmental, who's all good and all powerful. I consider that absurd, finally, for reasons I'm perfectly willing to get into. I believe in a God who's a creative God, who's doing the best that he or she can do against great odds. And when you start to speak of great odds, why do I say great odds? It's because nothing is easy in this existence. We have exaltation in this existence, and we have despair. And I think that is the measure, in my mind, of the conditions in larger places, in the universe as a whole. The universe is something being formed all the time. And so there are forces that fight each other. And I would personify some of those forces by speaking of the devil. Yes, absolutely.
We're talking this hour with author Norman Mailer, the two-time Pulitzer Prize winner and one of the greats in American literature in the last century, talking about his new novel, The Castle in the Forest. It's the story of the first 14 years or so of the life of Adolf Hitler, an imagined life in which he is led, shaped, how would you put it, Norman Mailer, by the devil himself? How would you describe the role the devil plays in the genesis of this man?
In the book, a very large liberty is taken. If one's going to believe, as millions of people do, that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and that the angel Gabriel was there at the conception with Mary, it seemed to me that Adolf Hitler was the devil's answer to Jesus Christ. He wanted someone who would be as evil as Jesus had been good. If we're thinking in terms of a devil's psychology, Jesus Christ was dreadful for the devil, got very much in his way, was very opposed to all the things the devil wished to do. The devil wanted to have a force that be comparable to Jesus, and he chose to enter the relations, these incestuous relations between Alois Hitler, the customs official, and his young wife, Clara Posel Hitler. And he was there, and the devil was there at the conception.
Do you think, here we are 2,000 years after the life of Jesus, do you think that Adolf Hitler will have that kind of historic staying power 100 years from now, 500, 1,000? Will people look back and say, there's the devil's answer to the biblical Jesus?
No, I hope not, and I think not. I think finally Hitler failed, but let us not delude ourselves. Hitler had a huge, ugly influence upon civilization. The damage that Hitler did to us is just beginning to be measured. You can't even get it, just to jump over a notion, You can't even get into a war like Iraq without having been poisoned in one's thinking by Hitler. The idiocy of President Bush speaking of Saddam Hussein as being a species of Hitler when Hitler was orders of magnitude more evil than an evil man like Saddam Hussein. But that's just the beginning of it. The real damage that Hitler did to civilization after the murder of 6 million people was precisely that he injured our ability to think clearly. Political correctness, which is an intellectual virus that may yet poison a great deal of human thought, comes from Hitler, comes from the fact that Hitler was so horrible that people cannot even begin to think clearly about all sorts of things. The damage he's done to my fellow co-religionists, the Jews, is immense, because we used to be an inquiring people, a people who were excited by new ideas, excited by new thoughts, new possibilities of looking at experience. And now, because of Hitler, there's a kind of Jewish caution that puts a wet blanket on all sorts of new thinking. The old joke of the Jews, is this good for the Jews, has now become an iron law. Stop all discussion that you don't feel in control of. Terrible thing for the Jews. I, as a Jew, feel it. I know it. And that's the damage that Hitler's done. There's a tragedy involved in Hitler, if you will, a tragic irony. which is the two nations of people who were most attracted to culture, who believed that culture could save existence, that culture could enrich existence, that civilization could finally take on all sorts of sinews and healthy dimensions by way of culture. Those are the two nations who were each injured the most. The Jews, who believed immensely in culture, just like the Germans, were destroyed by half, were decimated, and the Germans are still reeling from the shock of Hitler.
You spoke disparagingly just there of George Bush and his drawing of comparison between Adolf Hitler and Saddam Hussein. At the same time, George Bush has put the word evil back into the American vocabulary like no other secular figure I can think of. And that's very close to, when you talk about evil, you're close to talking about the devil. Do you feel you share some view of evil with this president and his fellow thinkers, or is it a different concept?
Well, I hope I don't, because frankly, his use of evil is ugly and manipulative. He'll use the word evil 10 times in a sentence. I don't think he even knows what it's all about. I don't think he's got a clue as to what evil is. What he does know is that people do react to the word evil, and so he uses it over and over and over, and it's most unpleasant. I think in my book, if I may speak on my own behalf, the notion of evil is most complex to me. The story is told by a devil who goes into all the matters that are related to evil in relation to Adolf Hitler as he grows up as a child. And I think it's a complex and, dare I say it, even a sophisticated notion of what evil might be. Evil isn't something that's easy to grasp, not the way Bush throws the word around.
In this kind of dualistic view of the world that you put to work here, the God, as described in your novel, as you say, is not all-powerful. He and the devil both kind of eyeing each other, looking for strengths and weaknesses. There's a bit on page 74, I wonder if you could read, that gets to some of that back and forth between the devil, the maestro, your word, in The Castle in the Forest, and God. It gives us a bit of that complexity. Could you read that for us?
Yes, indeed. When it comes to turning a child into a client, we follow a reliable rule. We move slowly. While an incestuous procreation, followed by swarms of mother love, will offer rich possibilities, particularly when the event has been fortified by our presence at conception, and we have therefore every reason to expect exceptional potentiality to be present for us, still we wait. We observe. The child may not live. We lose so many. All too often, God is aware of our choice, and heartlessly, I will say this about him, yes, God can remove certain children heartlessly, no matter the cost to himself. The cost to himself? A curious calculation is present. The Lord is not insensitive to the hopes of those who surround the young one. The early death of an exceptional child can demoralize a family. Even when he knows, therefore, that a given individual has been in good part captured by us, he hesitates. Sometimes he does not wish to take on the collateral damage to the family. Besides, his angels can always look to steal the child back from us. So the Lord is respectful of mother love, even when it is all-embracing. It can come as no surprise, then, that many artists, ogres, geniuses, killers, and an occasional savior live to maturity because God chose not to dispose of them. The first element of mutual recognition in the struggle between the Dummkopf, as we shall now often call him, and our leader, the maestro, is their mutual understanding that no single splendid human quality is likely to prevail by itself, unaltered by his powers or ours. Even the noblest, most self-sacrificing and generous mother can produce a monster, provided we are present. All the same, this is not a game where we can count on the end result. That is why investing in the newborn is an unbalanced gamble for both the maestro and the Lord.
Norman Mailer reading from his new novel, The Castle in the forest, and the narrator there, again the demon, the sort of mid-tier devil, Dieter, telling us how it's done. And the back and forth between the devil, the big guy, and the maestro and the Lord, they refer to God, they being the demons, as he describes them, as the Dummkopf, sort of dummy in German. Why?
The devil, the maestro, says them at one point. He doesn't say it to them, but Dieter explains it. He says, in effect, that it isn't that we really think he is the Dummkopf. It is just that the devil doesn't want us to be too respectful of glorious sunsets and all the various powers of God that are so evident. And so he encourages us to use the expression the Dummkopf or the DK in order that we lose some of our respect for God.
Norman Mailer, you're turning 84 this week. So much work done on so many fronts. You've opened yourself up again and again in these novels and opened up human spirit and the world to us in the process. Years ago, Christopher Leeuwenhaupt talked about your Manichaean ox team, your God and devil in harness. Over these decades, as you've grown and then grown older, how has your own sense of God and the devil changed? Is it more or less literal now? Is it how's it moved?
Oh, I think if I put a word on it, I'd say that the thinking is now perhaps more intimate. In other words, I'm interested more in the some of the small details of what might be possible in an ongoing war between God and the devil, which is one of the reasons I wrote this book, is I really, really wanted to have an opportunity to study the way a devil might work. Now, mind you, I'm a novelist. We make things up. We create fictions. And it seemed to me this was an interesting avenue to pursue because it was unexplored. You know, one of the great problems for serious novelists today is that most of the good things have been done in the past. Mm. And most of them, to use a parallel to America, it's as if the West has now been cultivated. Mm. And so where do you go? Where do you go? Do you go to Alaska? No, too cold. Mm. So Americans no longer can explore into new territory the way we did 150 years ago. And in that sense, this seemed to me to be an equivalent of a land grab in the West to try to write about a devil. And, of course, I've been thinking about it for many, many years. Probably for 50 years I've had these religious ideas, maybe longer. And so even in The Naked and the Dead, at one point one of the characters says, if there is a God, he sure must be a son of a bitch. And the other person says, oh, don't say that. And at the time when I wrote it, I was thinking, what an odd remark. And it stayed with me. The beginning of the notion that God might not be all perfect probably came to me about that point.
Does it? This may be too personal or too intimate, but does it become more real with age? I mean, at a certain time of life, God and the devil, in a way, are or could be material for a novel. But at another age, 84, 94, or 104, you sound greatly vigorous, and we wish you many years, but you've got to be at some point aware of, you know, the great beyond. Does it make thinking about God different?
It's more intimate, and you do think about it more. I'm a great believer in reincarnation. It's the only thing that makes sense to me. The notion that we go through all we go through, you know, we all lead such curious lives, so full of good deeds and ugly, clumsy deeds, foul deeds, sour deeds, noble deeds. There's such a mixture of good and bad in all of us that the fundamentalist notion that you go either to heaven or to hell has always struck me as absurd. You know, to think that suppose your moral nature is 53 good, 47 bad, and lo and behold, you go to Club Med and you're basking in some sort of heavenly sun for the rest of existence. Or if you're on the contrary, if you're only 47 good and 53 bad, there you go into the fires of hell and burn forever. It strikes me as being absolutely nonsensical in relation to God's needs. God created our existence, our universe. For God, as a creator, what's important is that the creation be maintained and developed and grows. And so reincarnation strikes me as very sensible from God's point of view, because he can take those of us that he's not quite satisfied with, his early creation, so to speak, and send us back again and perhaps improve on learning from us. He can improve on that creation. One of my notions is that God learns from us. that we're not simply there as little page boys to carry out, or little supernumeraries in an opera to carry out this great stage program. But on the contrary, we're God's children. We're created by God. God learns from us in the same way that we learn from our own children. And therefore, God is interested in recreating us to see how we do in a somewhat different existence. So as I say, being a great believer in reincarnation, I find that these thoughts about God and the devil are not fearsome. They're almost comfortable.
Your demon in The Castle in the Forest talks about another category of people. Humans have become so vain through technology, Dieter, the devil says, that more than a number expect by now to become independent of God and the devil. There's the demon speaking with some incredulity. What about you, Norman Mailer? What do you make of people who want to live beyond both, all?
Oh, I think there's no question in my mind that humans are now a third force. That, let's say in the Middle Ages, I've said this before, but humans were like peons, and they shivered in terror before the notion of God and the devil. They couldn't make a move without thinking, oh, God's at my left, at my right hand, the devil's at my left hand. What have I done today? How are they with me? How are they against me? And in the Enlightenment, another force began to assert itself, which is humans began to think, no, we are important. We're important enough to do some of our own thinking. And this has gone on to the point now in the third or fourth century of the Enlightenment where there are many, many humans who believe in neither God nor the devil. They believe that humans are the ones who are important. And in a certain sense, humans have become a third force. I think probably it could be said that technology is the representative of that third force, which could bring humans to considerable good or could just as easily, in my mind, destroy existence forever.
But you have your demons say humans are at present doing their best to be beholden neither to God nor to the maestro, the devil. They seek to be free. Your words through a narrator's mouth, do you see that as an achievable freedom?
Well, I don't. No, I don't. But I do think it's true that there may even be a majority of humans by now whose first passion is to be free, and free of God and the devil, particularly.
If it's not possible, but that's the passion, what's the consequence?
If you ask me a question, what's the consequence? All we have to do is look at the world at any given moment, and there's no need to ask what the consequences are. We live in a world that's all mucked up all over the place, constantly. Troubles in every nation, horrors in many a nation, disappointments all over the place. A messed up civilization.
Because humans yearn to be free of both God and devil, or because they haven't pulled it off?
For a variety of reasons. One is because humans may seek to be too free without thinking of the consequences. Certainly because God and the devil have terrible wars, which are visited upon us. There are a variety of reasons. The one thing I would argue is let's not go in for simplicities, ever. I'm totally opposed to the notion that there are simple answers, that if we get a hold of one answer, that'll do it all for us. That's what I can't stand about George Bush. He has one answer for everything. We, good Americans, are fighting evil. It's a bunch of crap. You know, some Americans are good, some are not. Some Islamics are horrible people, some are not. The notion that we are fighting evil, that we are fighting terrorists, and all terrorists are evil, is an absurdity. Mm. He wouldn't know a terrorist if he met one. Nor would I.
We're talking this hour with author Norman Mailer about his new novel, The Castle in the Forest. Norman Mailer turns 84 this week. He's been writing at the very top of the American literary pyramid for nearly six decades now. It's a long time. The latest book tracks the youth from his very conception of Adolf Hitler, a project, Norman Mailer says, of the devil. Mailer has been an activist speaking out on many fronts for a long time. Norman Mailer, if you would, I'd like to listen back to some tape of yourself. This is May 21st, 1965. You were speaking at one of the largest teach-ins protesting the Vietnam War. Here you are at University of California, Berkeley, on a playing field there, speaking before a crowd of about 30,000 students, teachers, and protesters in 1965.
Existence alters the nature of essence. An unjust war, an unnatural war, an obscene war, brutalizes what is best in a nation and encourages every horror to rise from its sewer. The communists could capture every nation on earth but our own, and we would still be safe if our intention were clean.
Norman Mailer in 1965 at Berkeley, would still be safe as long as our intention were clean. How do you see the American situation now, 2007, this war in Iraq becoming much more than most anyone seemed to bargain for?
Well, I don't think our intentions have been the least bit clean in relation to Iraq. I think what we had was a war that began for a variety of motives. There were several principals who were pushing the war forward, the president, the vice president, any number of advisors, any number of neocons. They all had a different agenda. We'll come to the president last. I think the first and the most important of the people who were pushing the war forward was Dick Cheney. And Dick Cheney, I think to this day, probably sees himself as a patriot, because his feeling about that war was, we are heading into real oil troubles down the road. If we don't get some control of some Middle Eastern country's oil in large quantities, we're going to suffer a terrible depression in 5, 10, 15 years when the price of oil goes sky high because of shortages, and we'll be held up by the Middle Eastern countries. So we have to take over a country, and Iraq is the best excuse because they got that ugly fellow Saddam Hussein there. Let's use Iraq. That was Cheney's view of it. I think the neocons, in turn, had totally different motives. They wanted to bring democracy to Iraq because they felt if Iraq became a democratic country, then that would, then at least the hideous war of attrition between the Middle East and Israel could quiet down, that it would show the example to other countries that they could live with Israel. It was a noble notion, but completely unfounded. You don't bring democracy to a country where the dominant passion in the two halves of the country is to slay the other half. You don't build democracy on the desire to murder. And on top of that, the irony and the sad irony of this one is that the situation of the Israelis is now worse than it was before this war started. And it has been brought on, that's been brought on them by the attempts of the neocons to solve Israel's problems.
And the president?
Which was a folly. I consider that a folly from the neocons. I don't even know if half of the good Israelis were even consulted on that one.
And the
and
president?
Then you come in, we come to the president. The president, I think, was the most ignorant president in our history, and he really didn't know what to do. There were a lot of problems in America. The FBI was leaking with scandals. The Catholic Church was whittled with scandals. At that time, the market was down. There were problems all over the place, and he didn't have a clue on how to solve any domestic problems. And so he thought a war would be great. He'd been a cheerleader. His father had been an athlete, and he'd been a cheerleader. That sets up an unhealthy need to act out a macho part rather than to be macho. And what could be more of a macho part than being the leader of the great American democracy in a war against terror? And so he thought entirely in terms of slogans, and the people in Iraq who wanted a war, the Chalabis, all played on that notion most intensively. And so we went to war in Iraq, and we went with impure motives all over the place.
And yet, if there was impurity and around, there was plenty on all sides. Saddam Hussein was certainly no angel in your dualism. I mean, if it's a misbegotten war, I don't know, can you bring your God and the devil battlefield to this war? Who's lining up where?
Well, you have to go in for a little caustic counting. Yes, Saddam Hussein was killed. He was executed. He was dethroned. But what we've had since then has been a civil war that has gotten worse and worse and worse, where the people are living in prodigious anxiety all the time, where somewhere between 30,000 and 60,000 Iraqis have been killed because of that war, which is as much as many people killed in a couple of years as Saddam Hussein have been doing lately. I don't know that we've improved their existence. The saddest truth that has to be faced is that when people live in a fascist country, not everyone who lives in that fascist country is miserable. For a lot of people, what they get is a kind of quiet and order because they are not opposed to the system. And unpleasant and ugly as that is, they may have been living, a great many people in Iraq may have been more comfortable back under Saddam Hussein than they are right now. And the fact that I don't see how we're going to get to a democracy for that very simple reason. When you have the Shiites and the Sunnis not only hating each other, feeling murderous toward each other, but having felt that way for more than 1,000 years, I don't know how you can begin to have a democracy. In America, for example, we have great divisions between the blue states and the red states, great divisions between, let's say, Northeast left intellectuals and Southern fundamentalists. We're not ready to murder each other at all. We still live in a democracy. We're still willing to work it out through the vote. If we were ready to kill each other, we couldn't have a democracy.
You saw how Vietnam came and upset and went. What about this war? What impact do you foresee for the United States? Leave alone the Middle East for a moment. Have those Americans looked into the maw of this war and begun to close the gaps, the cultural and political gaps, or some other path out of this war?
I feel as ignorant as the people who are leading the war. To wit, I don't know what will happen if we were to pull out, for example. They don't know either. They keep talking about an onrush of terrorism, which is a nonsense, I think, for a very simple reason. When we pulled out of Vietnam, there were people who talked about how all of the Far East was going to fall. And in fact, what did happen? Today, Vietnam is a perfectly peaceful country. There's no threat coming to us from Southeast Asia. All the fears that the communists were going to take over all of Asia didn't come to pass. The Chinese communists had already taken over, so it was a question of would Southeast Asia turn communist? It didn't. I think much of the same is likely to happen in the Middle East. For example, if we were to pull out, the Shiites would be supported by Iran and the Sunnis by Saudi Arabia and the Syrians. Those countries do not want to go to war with each other. Mm. They'd be very nervous. It'd be terribly expensive for them to go to war. The Saudis could afford it. I don't think the Syrians could, nor could the Iranians. And so I think, on the contrary, what might happen is they might get very cautious, and they might pull back their insurgents on each side and say, this is not the time to fight. Let's wait. We can do better later.
What about on the home front? You know, after the Vietnam War had a long tail, what do you anticipate with this war? Do you think that the cost of it, the dismaying fact of it, has sobered up Americans, sort of slapped them out of their culture war polarity, or do we go deeper into that?
Well, I keep hoping that this country becomes a greater democracy, not a lesser one. What people don't realize about a functioning democracy like America is that democracy has an element of love in it, a love of one's fellow human being that's crucial to the continuance of democracy. And love is an emotion. When two people are in love, that relationship either improves or deteriorates. There's no such thing, or let's say the rarest thing in the world is to find two humans who love each other at the same level for many, many years. No, there are periods where they love each other more, and there are periods when they love each other less. And the saddest thing about love, and the most dangerous thing about love, is love can turn to its opposite. It can turn into corruption. It can turn into hatred. It can turn into a sourness of spirit. Not everybody is enlarged by love. Some people are diminished. Same is true with democracies. When you have a democracy, that democracy has to grow and prosper and develop, or it's likely to turn into worse. A democracy is a fragile democratic growth. It's no accident that it only came into existence in the last couple of centuries. And it's very important that a democracy, as I say, develop in a fine fashion rather than a sour, bad fashion. And I think this democracy has been deteriorating, not crucially yet, but still deteriorating for the last 10 years, and certainly has not gotten better while Bush has been in. He's injured it. I'll even go further. I think that the leader of a democracy, it's very important that such a leader speak the home language well. It's important because people take their cue from the President of the United States. Mm. And if he speaks beautifully, speaks well, as Franklin Delano Roosevelt did, people are enlarged and their intelligence develops. Whereas if you speak in cliches all the time, like George Bush, you are doing your best willy-nilly to render the populace a little more stupid. Mm.
Norman Mailer, I want to take it back once more, if I may, to the new novel and the castle
sure.
in the forest. There's a reading, page 405, I wonder if you might turn to, late in the book, writing about Hitler in the war. There's a reference here to Edmund's death. This would be his brother, who he kissed to give measles, and the boy later died, a reference here to Luigi Lucchini, the Italian anarchist. But you speak here to the extermination of humans and and the surround of Adolf Hitler. Could you read there for us?
Adolf Hitler's readiness to exterminate humans in the gas chamber was obviously not at this time in 1900 an active longing. If I speak, therefore, of a year like 1945, it is to make no direct connection to the months after Edmund's death. Wholly guided in those years by the maestro, I was looking to do no more than intensify some early sense that Adolf might yet become a high agent of the gods of death. That did allow him to believe that his own end would not be like others. Of course, I had no real expectations as yet of the dimensions to come. I would have done the same for Luigi Lucchini if he had been my client when he was young. I do find it interesting, however, that close to the last few months of his life, Hitler did wish to be cremated. The meanest aspect of his life had always been his body, but by then, late in life, his soul, by any but our measure, was more befouled than his torso. Of course, it is also true that when one has become an overseer of death who holds the power to liquidate masses of people, one is also in great need of a very hard shell to the ego in order to feel no intimate horror over the price to one's soul. Most statesmen who become successful leaders of a country at war have usually risen to such eminence already. They have installed in themselves an ability not to suffer sleepless nights because of casualties on the other side. They now possess the mightiest of all social engines of psychic mummification, patriotism. That is still the most dependable instrument for guiding the masses, although it may yet be replaced by revealed religion. We devils love fundamentalists. Their faith offers us every promise of developing into the final weapon of mass destruction.
Norman Mailer reading from late in his new and latest novel, The Castle in the Forest. I want to ask you about the role of the writer in all this. There's several references in the book to the devil-loving writers, I guess because of their capacity to, the kind of shamanistic ability almost to share visions. He says, if only they could have got Mark Twain on board, how great that would have been. Maestro, the devil would have, if he had it shot, he would have gone after Mark Twain himself. What about the role of the writer? Have you felt yourself tempted to the demonic side that you describe here? Is it a danger?
Well, if you're a serious novelist, you're interested in everything. You're interested in everything that's not easy to grasp quickly and dismiss in a sentence. So you're interested in God, you're interested in the devil. But I'd rather talk about the notion in the book that's presented, which is that the devil's interested in good writing. DT, in talking about it, says that the maestro always wants them to know, learn more and more about human nature because it's important for their purposes that they understand how humans function. And so
The devil's armies or humans themselves?
The devil's armies. Mm-hmm. The devil's armies, he wants... The maestro, the devil, wants his armies to become better and better at understanding human beings.
So whose side are you on? Whose side are you on then, Norman Mailer, in laying it all out?
Let me finish the thought.
Yeah.
So he's always pushing them to read good literature. And the devil then goes on to say, my devil who's speaking, he says, we love best-selling writers for their sentimental inexactitudes. They're always polluting human consciousness, which we like. The notion is not that the devil is happy with high human consciousness, with fine people, quite the contrary. But he feels they have to be understood in order to be defeated.
And you may be a vehicle of that. How do you feel about that?
How do I feel about what?
Demonic armies understand the human race.
Do I feel I'm working for the devil? No, sir. No. Now, I could be wrong. We can all be wrong. I love Kierkegaard's notion that the moment when you feel you're most saintly, you could be working for the devil, and vice versa. At times when you think you're depraved or hideous, at that moment God might be with you. Kierkegaard presented that notion in order to get us over the self-satisfaction of being judgmental. So, no, you don't know your own nature. It's not for us to say our nature is good or bad. It's not for me to say I'm working for God or for the devil or for myself. Any one of the three could be true in varying proportions. But I'm not going to stand here and say I am one or the other, nor can anyone else in my mind. No one human.
You're 84 this week. How long do you keep up this effusion, Mr. Mailer?
Well, I'd like to be able to write one more book at least, yeah. That means another 2 or 3 years, and that means we'll see. At my age, you can't make predictions. You can wake up any given morning and half your head's gone, you know, through something unhappy happening in your body. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to make any predictions.
We don't ask for promises, but we hope for it. And we thank you for spending this time with us today. Norman Mailer's new book is The Castle in the Forest. Norman Mailer, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.